Okay, so let's get started. So we have to finish today analyzing the RGE flow equations for the Costa-Litzalis transition. So I have the following two equations for the vortex fugacity and for temperature. So 2 minus pi over T y, and then dT. dl is y squared divided by 2t. And so I drew yesterday the kind of the general shape of the flow diagram that we get from this. So there is a special point here on the t-axis where t is equal to pi over 2. So as we will see, there are two kind of straight lines, two asymptotes that meet at this point, okay? And in particular, this line is the line of phase transitions. So everywhere on the left of this line, the flows just go into the y equals 0 axis, right? So this looks like just a line of fixed points, right, where vortex fugacity is 0. And vortex fugacity being 0 means that all the vortices are bound into with the anti-vortices. So if you do coarse graining, the vortices are just disappear. They're not seen. Okay. So this corresponds to the low temperature phase, right, where there are no vortices. And then everywhere to the right of this line, we have flows going to infinity, which means that that the vortex density grows under renormalization, which simply means that if you start from some finite free vortex density, when we start rescaling the length, the density increases. Right? Okay, so now let's actually analyze those RGE equations quantitatively, okay? And so you can kind of see already from the form of those equations that this analysis is less trivial than what we did for the Ising model in the 4 minus epsilon expansion, because the right-hand side is non-linear, right? There are no linear terms, basically. Well, except this 2y here, but the right-hand side for this equation is nonlinear, right? But so let's try to analyze it first in the same way, right? As we did before. So let's take this fixed point, t star equals pi over 2, and let's try to linearize those equations near this fixed point, right? So I can calculate the derivatives of the beta function, right? So I have beta sub t of t and y is equal to y squared divided by 2t. And then I'll have beta sub y of t and y. This is 2 minus pi divided by t times y, right? So if I calculate d beta t dt, right? So this is minus y squared divided by 2t squared. So if I take the value of this derivative at this fixed point, it vanishes, right? So y star equals 0, t star equals pi over 2. This is 0. Then d beta t dy, which is y divided by t. This also vanishes, right? So at y star and t star also vanishes. And the same is true for beta y. So d beta y d y is 2 minus pi over t. So this vanishes. and d beta y dt again vanishes, right? So this is pi divided by t squared y. So, you know, the stability matrix, right, from which we extracted the critical exponents before, so this just vanishes identically at this fixed point corresponding to the transition. So we really have to integrate those equations, you know, without making really any approximations except, you know, maybe closeness to this fixed point. Okay, so let's see how we can integrate those equations. So let me introduce new variables here. So I will call y squared. I will call z. Okay. And then 2 minus pi over t. I will call this x. 2 minus pi divided by t. Okay. And so let me rewrite those RG flow equations in terms of those new variables, z and x. Okay. So first of all, this fixed point now corresponds to just z and x equals 0, right? Z star is equal to 0, x star is equal to 0. And then, okay, so if I rewrite those equations, so let's say dz dl, right? So this is equal to what? So this is 2y times dy dl, right? So this is equal to so dz dl. So 2 dy dl is x, and then, yeah, xy squared. So this is equal to 2xz, right? And then, so dx dl, so this is pi divided by t squared dt dl, right? And the right, so this is equal to pi divided by t squared, and then the t dt dl is z divided by 2t, right? So z divided by 2t. And let me, so here, so I will analyze those equations only near this particular fixed point. So let me then replace this t here, t cubed, in the denominator by its fixed point value, so pi over 2. So this is approximately equal to z divided by so the pi 2 pi over 2 cubed. So this is z divided by pi over 2 squared, right? Okay. Okay, so I get, again, dz dl is 2xz, and dx dl is 2 divided by pi squared times x. So slightly nicer form than that. Okay. Now let me do the following. Let me divide this equation by this equation, so that this x can be canceled, right? So I get d z dx, right, is equal to pi squared divided by 2, right, times z. Okay, and this I can easily integrate. So if I integrate this equation, I get z of x is equal to pi squared over 2. Something is wrong here. This is supposed to be z, of course. You're not correcting me. So z gets canceled, not x. Okay. So if I integrate, I get again pi squared divided by pi divided by 2 squared, right, times x squared plus constant, which I will call sigma. Okay. And now since z is y squared, then I get the following equation. So y squared is equal to pi over 2 squared x squared plus sigma. Okay. So this this equation defines a family of hyperbolic curves, which are precisely those flow lines here. Okay. And so this family is parameterized by this parameter sigma, right? So when sigma is equal to zero, right, then I get two straight lines. So y is equal to plus minus pi over 2x, right? So those are those two straight lines, right? And since y is actually positive, then I have, so y is equal to this when x is greater than 0, right? And x is greater than 0 corresponds to t less than pi over 2, right? T greater than pi over 2, right? So this is this line, this straight line. And then when x is less than 0, so x greater than 0 corresponds to t greater than pi over 2, which is the same as tkt. And then y is minus pi over 2x when x is less than 0, which is the same as t less than tkt. So this is this straight line, right? So when sigma is greater than 0, right, sigma is greater than 0 corresponds to those lines which lie in this angle, so which lie above the two straight lines, the two straight asymptotes. Okay, so these lines correspond to sigma greater than 0, while these flow lines and these flow lines correspond to sigma less than 0. Right, so this is sigma less than 0, and this is also sigma less than 0. Okay, and so the lines corresponding to sigma less than 0 intersect the t-axis or the x-axis, let's say the t-axis, at the following points, right? So I just set here y equals 0. Okay, so this is above the asymptotes, and then sigma less than 0. The intersection points are x equals plus minus, so 2 divided by pi square root of modulus of sigma, right? Okay. Now, so let's think about, let's forget about this part. Let me just kind of cross it out here. So let's think about only this part of the flow diagram, right? Which would, you know, which would correspond to basically crossing this transition line at some finite value of u, right? You can only, I can only get to this directly to this side by crossing this critical point, this critical line exactly at y equals zero. Okay. So here on the left I have sigma less than zero, right? On the right I have sigma greater than zero. What this means is that for small deviation from this line, right, and close to this point, sigma can actually be identified with the distance to the transition temperature. So sigma, let me erase this thing. So sigma can actually say that sigma is proportional to T minus TKT divided by TKT, right? It's positive again. It's positive here on this side of the transition line, and it's negative here on this side of the transition line. Therefore, with some coefficient, it's just going to be proportional to T minus TKT divided by TKT. And the coefficient does not matter. Okay. So then, let me now solve this equation for x, okay? Assuming, let me assume that I am somewhere on this side of the transition. So t is greater than tkt, okay? So let me assume that t is greater than tkt, therefore x is positive, okay? And let me then solve for x, okay? So x is equal to, so 2 divided by pi square root of z minus sigma, okay? And sigma is also positive here. And let me integrate now, so integrate this equation dz dl is equal to 2xz along the flow trajectory, okay? So I have dz dl is equal to, so 4 divided by pi z square root of z minus sigma, right? So I can write this in the following way as dl, right, is equal to pi divided by 4 dz square root of z minus sigma, okay? And let me integrate this from L equals zero, let's say, you know, the starting point of my RG flow, which is going to be, I will actually take it to be at x equals zero, right? So somewhere along this line, which corresponds to x equals zero. Okay, so let's integrate from zero to, let's say, to 1, okay? Something of order 1, dl uh, Sorry, no, sorry, I screwed up. Let me integrate from 0 to L, okay? DL prime so is equal to pi over 4, again, integral from z of 0 to z of L, dz, did I miss? Yeah, I missed factor of z here. Z square root of z minus sigma. Okay. Now, so let me assume that I am very close to the critical temperature. So sigma, even though it's greater than 0, is much less than 1. Okay. So let me assume that sigma is much less than 1. So then I can neglect this sigma here. Okay. Sorry, I'm slightly ahead of myself here. So let me just assume that L, my you know, the finishing point of my RG transformation is such that Z of L is something of order 1. Okay, so let me take Z of L to be equal to 1. Okay, so then I have, so now I can neglect sigma here, so I have integral from Z of 0 to 1 dz z root z minus sigma. Okay. And also let's assume that in my as I said, I will start from some point on this line where x is equal to 0. Okay? Yeah.
So you said that we're assuming that the formula is going to be about the order of unity?
Sorry?
So you said we're going to assume the curve parameter is such that it will be flow until z of L is of order of unity?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you know that, you know, that principle could be pretty far away from the critical
Let me just continue, and then so we'll talk about the meaning of all of this. Okay, and so x of 0, I'm assuming that is equal to 0, therefore z of 0 is just sigma, right? Right, from there. So this is actually integral. So pi divided by 4, integral from sigma to 1, dz, z to the 3 halves, right? Which is going to give me pi over 2, right? And then square root of sigma. Again, because sigma, approximately because sigma is much less than 1. So I can neglect the contribution of this 1 here. Okay? Okay, so what do these limits mean, right? So I'm starting from z of 0 equals sigma, and sigma is small, right? So I'm starting from some small value of z. Now z, on the other hand, is equal to the vortex fugacity squared, okay? So the vortex fugacity basically determines the vortex density, right? So this means I'm starting from small, from a point at which I have small vortex density, right? So we are on the on the t greater than tkt side of the transition. So therefore, there are free vortices, okay? But I'm starting from a system in which the density of those vortices is small, right? What it means is that my cutoff length scale, right, to which I am, so I'm integrating, you know, I have modes with momenta from zero to inverse cutoff, right? And so it means that the cutoff is something that's much, much smaller than the correlation lengths, right? So the vortex density is large. And the vortex density is, so the separation between the vortices, this is basically the only length scale that characterizes the t greater than tkt side of the transition, and therefore that's the correlation lengths, right? So correlation lengths, let me erase this thing. So when t is greater than tkt, there is a finite density of free vortices, and the mean distance between them is the correlation length. Okay. So that correlation length becomes shorter and shorter as the temperature increases, right? And it diverges at tkt if I decrease the temperature towards the transition temperature. Okay, so this thing here means again that I'm starting from a point where psi is much, much greater than 1 divided by lambda, where lambda is my momentum cutoff, right? So vortex density is small. On the other hand, when z becomes something that's of order 1, right, it means that I have reached the point where the inverse cutoff has become of the order of the correlation lengths, right? Because the vortex density basically has become of order 1. So z equals 1 means that as I rescale lambda, basically psi has become of the order of b divided by lambda, where lambda is the original microscopic cutoff, right? Or in other words, my factor b, right, which is equal to e over l, right, has become so large that b divided by lambda has become of order of the correlation lengths. Okay. So therefore, I can say that psi is proportional to b to the l. Proportional to e to the l. Where L is equal to this, right? So this is my L. So this is equal to E pi over 2 divided by root sigma. And sigma, as we discussed, is proportional to T minus TKT divided by TKT. So therefore, I get that psi behaves as e to some constant, which is non-universal and whose value is not important. Therefore, and then, so square root of tkt t minus tkt. Okay. So this means that so you see that correlation lengths, unlike regular phase transitions, this order parameter where correlation length diverges as some universal power law, here, well, it also diverges in a universal manner, but it's not power law. It's much faster than any power law. Okay, and so this type of divergence of the correlation length is characteristic of Costa-Lizalis transition. Yeah. Sorry?
Why did this happen?
Why did what happen?
That we're not no longer have power law.
Well, I mean, it's formally, I guess, it's because those equations cannot be linearized near the fixed point.
Was there something about the physical system that I could look at?
Well, the physics is that there is no order parameter, so it's a really unusual transition. Right. So the transition has to do with, rather than vanishing of order parameter due to fluctuations, it has to do with unbinding of topological defects. Formally, this kind of complicated dependence just comes from the fact that RG equations cannot be linearized near fixed point. Okay. Well, because, this is what correlation length is, right? So correlation length is some characteristic length scale, right? So when t is greater than tkt, the only characteristic length scale we can think of is the distance between the vortices. It's pretty much, by definition, that's what I mean by the correlation length, right? Since there is no order parameter in this case, right, I can't think of order parameter being correlated on some length scale. So this is the only characteristic length scale. Yeah.
So Mark, you're making that argument because we're working with the density of vortices, which is what changes from one part of the,
right.
From right to the point to the left. Isn't that saying that the density of vortices here is the order parameter of the system?
Well, sure, except, what's usually meant by order parameter is something that's, it's not just that, order parameter is zero on one side of the transition and not zero on the other side. It's also something that's local, that you can associate, let's say, magnetization with a particular point in space in the system, and then think of long wavelength fluctuations of that quantity, and that's what gives you the usual picture of phase transitions, where it's some local some quantity which can be defined locally, but then there are long wavelength fluctuations which make the when temperature is high enough, which make the average of that quantity zero. But here, sure. I mean, you can define vortex density as order parameter for t greater than tkt, right? But it's not a local quantity, right? It's a quantity that's global. It's a different.
So there's another system with this topological defects are present. So we expect that we will have global order parameters instead of local order parameters, so that they're basically somehow robust to what happens locally, and it's just.
Well, no, the topological defects can be present. Let's say if I consider this XY model in three dimensions, I will also have topological defects, which would be vortex lines. Right. Same vortices, just their course would be lines instead of points, but in that case they just don't play such an important role, because in that case there is an order parameter. So for low temperatures, there is a non-zero average of E to I theta. And in that case, the transition can be described in terms of order parameter. So in this case, the vortices play such an important role because there is no order parameter. Okay. Okay. So, so actually, your comment about order parameter is kind of well placed because so there is a quantity which we can use not the vortex density but another quantity which we can use kind of like an order parameter here, which is going to be non-zero. When t is less than tkt and zero when t is greater than tkt, but it's also a global quantity. So let me now talk about this. So in my original Hamiltonian, right? So I have j minus j sum over I and j, right? Cosine of theta I minus theta j, right? And when I calculate partition function, I have so basically trace of e to minus a minus h divided by t, which means it's a integral product over I d theta I of e to j divided by t sum over I and j cosine of theta I minus theta j. So basically, how strongly the thetas are allowed to fluctuate is determined by this dimensionless parameter j divided by t, right? So in my case, you know, since I've absorbed j into t, this parameter is just inverse temperature, okay? So let me call this parameter k, j divided by t. And so this parameter is called sometimes generalized rigidity. For the following reason. So if I take continuum limit of this thing, right, and I expand the cosine, then I'll get something like, you know, minus j divided by t times grad theta squared, right? So that grad theta squared looks very much like elastic energy of a solid, right? Which is also basically square of stresses or strains squared, right? So this looks very much like elastic energy of a solid, right? And because, well, another way to think about this is that, so this gradient theta squared term here, it penalizes any non-uniformity in theta, right? Just like, you know, elastic energy in a solid would penalize any kind of non-uniformity in a solid, right? And so this coefficient, the rigidity, determines basically how hard it is to create this non-uniformity, what kind of energy cost you're going to get. Okay. Now, so it turns out that, and so this j over t here, this is the kind of the microscopic rigidity, right? This is a coefficient that enters in a into the microscopic Hamiltonian. So this is rigidity at the scale of the lattice constant. So now if I see what happens to this coefficient under RG transformation, right, when I coarse grain, this k flows to its macroscopic value, right? Which determines how difficult it is basically to create non-uniformity in theta on the macroscopic scale. Okay. And so it turns out that when t is less than tkt, actually k flows to a finite value. So one way to think about the this system below the Costa-Lethalis transition is that it has macroscopic phase rigidity, meaning that, you know, if I take my so if you think again in terms of solid analogy, right? How do I know that something is a solid? I take let's say a solid rod and I try to twist it on one end, and that twist can be felt at the other end. So that's what it means that the solid rod is rigid, right? This twist is transmitted all the way to the other side of the system. Here I can try to twist the phase. So let's say I have some boundary conditions where a phase is fixed, right? I can twist the phase on one side of my system. And if there is an, so I can twist the phase on one side of the system relative to the other side. And if there is a finite energy cost for that, that means that the system possesses phase rigidity. Okay? Very similar to a solid. So it turns out that that's precisely the difference, the macroscopic difference between this system below TKT and above TKT. Below TKT, there is phase rigidity, while above TKT, there is no phase rigidity. Okay? So this is like a phase solid below TKT, but a phase liquid above TKT. Okay? So T less than TKT, there is a finite phase rigidity, while above TKT, no phase rigidity. So let's see how this actually follows from this flow diagram. Well, because so vortex so vortex is a defect in the phase, right? On one side of the vortex you have phase looking in one direction, on the other side of the vortex it's completely in the opposite direction. So if there are a lot of vortices in the system, it means that well, the phase is just completely scrambled, it fluctuates, and therefore there is no correlation, right? So, even though on both sides of the transition there is no long-range order in the phase, in the sense that the correlation function of e to I theta at one point and then the other point is going to zero as you take the separation to infinity. But still, on this side of the transition, the correlation is power law, right? While on the other side, it's exponential. And so power law correlation is actually enough to give you a finite rigidity, even though there is no long range order. But the power law correlation is enough to create phase rigidity. While exponential correlation, that's definitely short range, right? And so that gives you zero rigidity. Okay. So let's do the following. Let's take this this phase diagram, right, and imagine doing the following thing. So let me take limit. So let's say delta t is some small deviation, of temperature from TKT, and let's consider the following limit. So limit of delta T going to zero from above, okay? and then the limit of infinite RG time, right, L of, so this rigidity K of L, and then TKT minus delta T, right? So slightly below TKT, and then minus K of L, and then TKT plus delta T, so slightly above TKT. So let me lower this thing, so let's see what happens there. So in this, in my notations here, T is just 1 over K, right? Since I've absorbed J into T. So I can, this axis is just 1 divided by K, right? And so if I am anywhere on this side of the transition, right? Wherever I start, I always flow to the y equals 0 axis, right? And so if I'm infinitesimally, you know, if I'm approaching TKT, I'm flowing then to 1 over k equals pi over 2, right? So this limit here for this quantity is just equal to 2 divided by pi, right? While if I am anywhere above TKT, right, 1 over k always flows to infinity, which means k is flowing to 0, right? So the limit of this quantity is always 0, right, which means that exactly at TKT, rigidity jumps by 2 divided by pi. Okay. So this means if I plot now, let's say J, let's do K. K, oops. No, let's actually do J. Sorry. If I plot J now as a function of T, right? So J just means that I've multiplied that rigidity K by temperature, okay? So it's gonna look like this. It's gonna be something finite, and this is TKT. It's gonna be something finite below TKT, right? And it's gonna start decreasing. But then exactly at TKT, it experiences a jump right, whose value is equal to 2 divided by pi times TKT. Okay, so the magnitude of this jump here is 2 divided by pi times TKT. So the ratio of J divided by TKT is a universal. The ratio of jump divided by the temperature is universal, right? So this delta J divided by TKT is equal to 2 over pi. So there's a universal jump of rigidity at the KT transition. And so this is probably the most striking feature of Gostolitz-Thalwitz transition. And so this, in fact, can be measured, okay? So and has been measured. So, you know, the most straightforward physical realization of this transition is a superfluid to normal transition in films of superfluid helium, okay? So in that case, so if I take superfluid helium 4, So the order parameter in that case is the wave function. So the, you know, the atoms of the of helium 4 condense into a state with a single, which is described by a single wave function, right? Even though it's a many-body system, the essence of superfluidity is the is that all the atoms become correlated and are characterized by a single wave function. And that wave function basically becomes like an order parameter. So if I call this wave function, let's say phi of x, right? It's a complex function, has a real and imaginary part. So that's the mapping to this to the xy model, right? XY model corresponds to spins with two components. The two components here are the real and imaginary parts of phi. Okay. So, you know, or I can write it in the following way as modulus of phi times e to I theta, and then the theta is going to be precisely my theta here. Okay? Yeah.
So in superfluid helium 4, is there still an analog of the vortices?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so the vortices, these are the actual vortices, right? So these are vortices in that in the phase of the in the phase of the wave function, right? So and so indeed, in this case, what's observed is precisely this kind of phase transition. So the rigidity in this case can be measured by a, you know, torsional oscillator experiment, where basically, you know, if this film is in a normal fluid state, right, and you oscillate it like this, then since it's in a normal fluid, right, it oscillates with the apparatus, basically with whatever oscillates. But if it's superfluid, then it basically decouples from the apparatus, and the moment of inertia correspondingly of this oscillator decreases. And so from that you can actually extract this rigidity, and it's observed that indeed it has this kind of universal jump. Yeah.
So we know that for T greater than the critical temperature, I have many vortices that are unbinded, right?
For T greater, yeah.
And for T greater, they are binded. So it's not clear to me why I should expect that I have a rigid phase when I have the binded vortices. If I want to flip a little bit this pin, right, in the boundary, it wouldn't cost more energy if I have the vortices unbinded than when they're binded?
No, because, you know, what presence of vortices does is basically makes the correlation lengths for the phase finite, right? That means finite correlation lengths means that if you have a large system, then if you do something to the phase on this side, there will be no memory if you go from this boundary more than a few correlation lengths. While when it's infinite, then there is a memory, and therefore there is rigidity.
Never specify boundary conditions for the system, right? We're just looking at the bulk of the system.
Okay.
Does it matter if I take different boundary conditions? I mean, because I'm knowing my system with different topologies for
right.
different boundary conditions, right.
right?
And since I have here topological defects, should that matter as well?
Well. Right. So in the low temperature phase, I mean, that rigidity basically means sensitivity to boundary conditions, right? I mean, if I have my system now and I make phase on this side something, force the phase here to be theta 1 and phase here to be theta 2, right? If in the low temperature phase, if theta 1 is not equal to theta 2, that state will have higher energy than the state with theta 1 and theta 2 equal. That precisely means that the rigidity to twist of the phase, right? While in the high temperature phase, there will be no difference. So in that case, there is no sensitivity to boundary conditions because correlation length is finite. Well, that's the only thing I can think of.
I mean, my question was pointing out to essentially that this sort of system, I mean, for example, this system seems to be robust to local perturbations, right? It only affects the order phase somehow is characterized by global properties.
Right.
And one of those global properties might be the topology of the space you're considering, right? So the question is, if this is some kind of topological order for...
Well, it's not, okay, so yeah, I understand what you mean now. It's not, there is a concept of topological order in the, I guess, which refers to quantum systems, right? In that case, there is degeneracy of the quantum mechanical ground state that depends on topology, right? You may have, I don't know, degeneracy equals 2 on a cylinder or degeneracy 4 on a torus. So there is no such thing here because this is a classical system, right? I mean, these things are not unrelated, I guess. So indeed, there is some kind of notion of classical topological order. Maybe that's characterized by this rigidity. So another realization, which is not as easily observable experimentally, unfortunately, but it's very nice because it more directly kind of explains that relates to this concept of rigidity. It's melting of 2D solids. So you know, a two-dimensional solid. As I mentioned, so we can think of solid as, you know, ordered arrangement of atoms, right? A crystal. So this kind of ordered arrangement of atoms breaks a continuous symmetry, which is continuous symmetry of translations in space. So therefore, according to Merman-Wagner theorem, in two dimensions, at any finite temperature, there cannot be solids in this sense of, having ordered arrangement, perfectly ordered arrangement of atoms. Okay. However, it's not actually true in the sense that you can have a finite rigidity for temperatures below some finite temperature, which is like Costa-Lizalis transition temperature. So in the case of the 2D solids, the analog of vortices would be topological defects in the crystal lattice, which are dislocations, which is basically a missing plane or missing line of atoms. All right, like so. Let's say you have solid here. And then here, this line of atoms suddenly stops. Okay, so this kind of missing crystal plane is like a vortex, because if you start from this, you can define it by a score here at this point where the line starts, right? And you can detect the presence of this missing line infinitely far away, if you calculate what's called the Burgers vector, which basically counts, how many atoms you have on each side, right? And if there is a this kind of missing atom here, then the Burgers vector will be finite. Yeah. Continuous symmetry is the symmetry of translations in space, right? So when the crystal forms, no, but the right, but the Hamiltonian for a solid, right, would only depend on the difference between displacements, right? It doesn't depend on specific positions, because all positions in space are equivalent. So. When solid forms, atoms have to take particular positions in space, but all positions in space are equivalent. So therefore, when the solid forms, it breaks this continuous symmetry of translations in space. Okay, and so in 2D solids, and so in let's say in three-dimensional solids, if you calculate correlation function of position of let's say these atoms at some point in the crystal and position of atom at some infinitely far away point, this correlation function is going to be finite. Okay, but in the 2D solid, at any finite temperature, this correlation function decays algebraically, just as in the XY model. Right, but when it decays algebraically, there is still a finite rigidity, so it's still in this sense a solid. Okay, if I twist it on one end, the twist is going to be felt on the other end. However, at high enough temperature, what happens is that these topological defects, so dislocations, unbind. Okay, there are free. So below this transition, dislocations are bound into just like vortices into pairs which have zero topological charge, right? And then at high enough temperature, dislocations unbind, and that leads to loss of rigidity. Okay? It's slightly more complicated than that because there are actually two types of topological defects in 2D solids. There are dislocations, and there are also disclinations, which I will not be able to draw. These correspond to basically defects in the orientation. Okay, so the way I've drawn it here, let's say each atom has a fourfold orientation, but if there is any defect in that orientation, let's say instead of fourfold, I have suddenly sixfold or something like that, then that's called a disclination. And so actually the melting transition proceeds in two steps. So first, dislocations unbind, but the disclinations are still bound, and then disclinations unbind. But both of those transitions are closely related to Costa-Lethalis transition. They're not exactly the same, but very closely related. Okay. So this, I'm not sure if this has been observed conclusively. So, you know, one way to observe this is looking for how vortex lattice melts in two-dimensional superconductors. So in superconductors in magnetic field, in type two superconductors in magnetic field, if you apply magnetic field, there are vortices formed there. So that's vortices in the wave function of the paired electrons, and they form a two-dimensional solid, okay, if the superconductor is two-dimensional. And you can observe those vortices, okay, pretty much directly. So you can observe these vortex lattice melt as the temperature is increased. So in principle, it should follow this theory, but I guess it's probably still inconclusive whether it does or not. Okay. Okay. So well, I've basically exhausted my what I wanted to say. So I guess we can stop now. Yeah, I can just answer questions. Yeah.
So we said that the correlation link diverges at the TKT.
Right.
Does that not contradict the Riemann theorem?
No, it does not, because the diverging correlation lengths does not mean that you get a correlation function that's constant, right, at infinity. It still decays, but there's a power law. So it does not. Merman-Wagner theorem just says that there is no long-range order, meaning that there is no average value of the order parameter. The average value of the order parameter is zero always. Yeah. Well, right. So it looks like, yeah. So it looks like a first order phase transition, even though, you know, from other points of view, this transition is continuous. For example, the diverging correlation lengths, that's a feature of a continuous transition. So that's just, you know, it's just an unusual transition that doesn't really belong to any of those types. I mean, in principle, it's a continuous transition because correlation length diverges, right? So you would you would call it continuous transition, but since there is no order parameter, right, there is nothing that's, there is no quantity that actually vanishes continuously at this transition. Okay? I mean, this rigidity is not really a local order parameter.
Can you construct things where this non-local order parameter goes continuously?
Well, I mean, here it has to jump, right? I don't know if you can, and you know, this jump is not really, it's not really tunable, right? It's just a universal number, does not depend on detail. So if you have any system with the XY type symmetry, just rotations about an axis in some space, then it will always be like that. Yeah.
So what, when you follow the renormalization flows as you do in that lemma, what does that mean physically?
Well, physically it means that, so I'm integrating out, I'm integrating over Fourier components of all the, for my fields, right, with high wave vectors, right? Or so in the real space, that means coarse graining, meaning averaging over larger and larger spatial patches, right? So in one way you can visualize this is just, so if you have your lattice system, you know, close to your face, then you see all the microscopic details, meaning that it's a lattice, and you can maybe see every spin on the lattice, but if you take this further and further away, you will only be able to see coarser and coarser details. And so by doing RG, we are basically deriving this description of the system that's applicable on larger and larger scales. It's still the description of the, exactly the same system. It's just a description that you know, that focuses on longer and longer length scales, right? And you know, this is exactly what's relevant for, you know, let's say as far as the experiments are concerned, or you know, in the condensed matter system, right? You are in any condensed matter experiment, you are probing a system at low energies and long wavelengths. Right, you can't really, well, you can, but most of the time you're not interested in that, in probing, you know, a single atom, let's say, knocking out a particular atom in the system. What you're interested in is, you know, gentler probes, which are probing low energy and long distance physics that's going to be universal, maybe. Because the high energy and short distance physics is non-universal. It depends on details of a specific system. And for this reason, may not be very interesting, right? But the low energy and long distance physics is often universal, does not depend on details, and so for this reason, it's interesting. And SRG is basically a procedure for deriving this kind of low energy, long distance description. Okay.
Right. If I treat my system quantum mechanically, the same result would follow, or?
Well, so, I mean, some of the things just directly carry over. So I can consider, for example, well, so let's say the simplest quantum mechanical system I can treat along these lines would be, so I can take my Ising model, so minus J, sum on I and J, sigma Z I, sigma Z J, and add a transverse field to it, minus H, sum of I, sigma I X, right, where sigmas are now quantum mechanical operators, right, so the sigma X and sigma Z do not commute, right, the commutator of sigma X, sigma z, sorry, sigma zi, well, it's 2i sigma y, I guess. Let's say we are at zero temperature. Now t equals zero, there is still a phase transition in this system, which is driven by the ratio of h over j, right? So when h over j is large, all the spins will be just polarized along this field, right? So then, and in particular, sigma, the average of sigma z is going to be zero, right? Because spins polarized along x means that it's a linear combination of upspin and downspin with equal coefficients. While in the opposite limit, when h over j is much less than 1, then, I can basically, as a first approximation, just neglect this, and then it's a usualizing model, and at zero temperature is certainly going to be ordered, meaning that in this case there is a non-zero expectation value of sigma z. Okay? So there is a phase transition. It's also continuous, okay? And it's pretty easy to show that so phase transition in this model it's at zero temperature maps onto just a classical transition in a classicalizing model driven by temperature in one extra dimension. So let's say if I take 2D transverse field Ising model, then the zero temperature transition maps onto a classical transition in a 3D Ising model. Okay. So basically, you know, time here acts as an extra dimension. So for many quantum systems, this is true that a quantum transition in D dimensions maps onto a classical transition in D plus one dimension. But it's not always true. So some quantum transitions don't map onto classical transitions. And those are, well, typically the most interesting ones. Yeah.
So for example, for this Ising model, this realizing the fact that I still have this spontaneous symmetry breaking, right?
Right.
But can I have, for example, quantum transitions where no symmetry is broken?
Yeah, yeah.
So in that case?
So for example, something that would map onto a KT transition would be a 1D system of interacting bosons. So I have a chain, or not chain, just a one-dimensional, just 1D system of bosons, okay? So 1D interacting bosons. So in this case, there are two phases. There is what's called Luttinger liquid, which is analogous to the T less than TKT region of the XY model. And then there is a transition into something that's not Luttinger liquid, right? That's a KT transition. So this 1D system of interacting bosons sometimes maps onto a classical 2D XY model. But there are more exotic cases when you can't even map onto a classical phase transition in D plus one dimensions. Okay, so I guess if there are no more questions, thanks.